Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome, everybody. It's good to have you with us today. We are going to start the first part of our program taking a critical look at the Olympics that just happened in the last 17 days. The guests we had on last week, or tried to have on last week, David Zirin and Dr. Sarah Jackson. Then we'll be talking to folks about the pick of Paul Ryan as Romney's running mate, and have an interesting slew of guests, including Molly Stentz from the ORT in Madison, Wisconsin, has been covering this, Tom Schaller and Mark Nugent from different sides of the political aisle. And then we come back to Maryland to talk with some of our state senators about why they voted and how they voted on the gambling bill. All that coming up. Right now we turn this over to WEAA Traffic to check on the roads here in Baltimore. Those of you who don't live in Baltimore, enjoy our traffic. We'll be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome. I remind you as you join our conversation here that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Marlene and Stuart Greenbaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center, online at www.umgcc.org. Or the number for more information is 1-800-888-8823. We're joined here by Dave Zirin, who is the sports editor for Nation Magazine and has his own commentary blog site called Edge of Sports, his own radio show called The Edge of Sports. Dr. Sarah Jackson is a contributing writer to Huffington Post, been covering some things in the Olympics, especially women and race at the Olympics. She's a postdoctoral fellow at Communication Studies at Northeastern. And Sarah Jackson and Dave Zirin, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks, Mark.
And the phone, and they're working.
Yes.
This is good. We could actually have the conversation today. This is great. Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on the Olympics. What stood out to you? What were the highlights, the lowlights? One of the things that the two of you have done, and start, Dave, I mean, is that on Edge of Sports, and you and your column, Sarah Jackson, have been kind of really kind of looking at the other side of these games, what the games have been saying to us socially and politically that we do not recover in great detail. And let me just start, Dave, with something you wrote about. We'll come back to Oscar Pistorius, who you wrote about just recently. But the piece you wrote on Gabby Douglas and the power of Gabby Douglas, I thought was really profound. Would you lay that out for us, for those who have not read your piece yet?
Well, sure. I mean, what I tried to talk about with regards to Gabby Douglas, who became the first U.S. woman in history to win the individual and be part of a team gold medal at the Olympics, as well as being the first person of African descent from any country to win the individual gold at the Olympics in gymnastics. What I wrote about her was her power as a representative political figure, and the point I was trying to make is that when we talk about political athletes, historically, they really come in two categories. So they're the people like Muhammad Ali or Billie Jean King, who are explicitly political, who use their platform to say political things. And then you have people who really have the power of representative politics, people who merely by taking the field, like when Jackie Robinson did that first game in 1947 when he broke the color line, or when Jack Johnson became the first African-American heavyweight champion, or when Martina Navratilova took the court and played tennis with a strength and musculature that people had not seen in women's athletes before. When that happens, that is also something very political. That's also something that has the power to inspire. That's also something that's the power to, I think, break people out of a certain cynicism about people's possibilities and potential. And I thought Gabby Douglas represented all of that. And to me, that was a huge bright spot in an Olympics where underneath the shiny surface, there was a lot of damage being done to the city of London and a lot of damage being done to the working people and poor people in the East End of London where the Olympics took place.
I want to come back to that last part. And Sarah, I wonder if you would reflect on that at all, too. I mean, I didn't see it in the writings in the Huffington unless I missed it, but I'm curious if you would reflect on that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Dave makes a really good point, which is that a lot of folks like to think that sports are apolitical, but in and of themselves, sports are political because we think about the fact that we have nations essentially competing against each other for, you know, images and bringing all these ideologies about what those nations stand for. And there are very much still narratives around certain members within those nations, certain groups. So the example of Gabby Douglas being the first person of African descent to win an individual gold medal that sometimes people aren't comfortable talking about because they would prefer this sort of, well, politics is a political narrative, when in truth, even if, and this is what I wrote about, you know, you watch the coverage and what you see is that even oftentimes the coverage falls back on these sort of archaic stereotypes and assumptions about different groups, whether it's women, whether it's black athletes, et cetera, that are very much political and very much reflect hierarchies within societies that are not always equal and are not always fair.
I mean, you reflected a lot in the pieces that I've read that you have written just about the continued kind of nature of sexism, as subtle as it might be and as overt as it might be, during these Olympics.
Right. And sometimes it was subtle and sometimes it was just so in your face, right? So the examples that I talk about are how, you know, women athletes face this double-edged sword where it's like the female volleyball players are talked about because of their bikinis, because, you know, their value is talked about as if the greatest thing about watching women's volleyball is the bikinis. And you even had the mayor of London make these really underhanded comments comparing them to wet otters, which is also just sort of bizarre, in discussing these highly accomplished female athletes who are at the top of their game and who should be being recognized for their athleticism and their hard work. And then on the other hand, you also have women athletes being subjected to criticism and critiques and sort of underhanded narratives that male athletes just aren't subjected to. So women athletes being called divas, women athletes being called girls when they are adults, you know, and all these sort of things that contribute to sort of suggesting that female athletes are not quite at the same level as male athletes, despite the fact that, and NBC acknowledged this yesterday in the closing ceremonies, if the women of the United States of America were their own country, they would have come in third in the overall medal count at the Olympics. They won more medals than the men of the U.S. And so it's really interesting to see how at one point, you know, we celebrate them, but at the same time, the language that we use to talk about them often is very undermining of the fact that they are women.
Dave?
Well, first, I would take it back to the Gabby Douglas discussion, because I think that that's a very, very good point and an important point, which is how these issues get discussed.
I'm sorry, did we lose Dave?
Hey.
I'm sorry, Dave, go for that. You're breaking up a little bit. Maybe it's your cell. I'm sorry.
Let me see if I can repatch in.
Go ahead. Go ahead. All right, he'll do that. Sarah, while Dave's doing that, I think that there's something we'll cover when he gets back as well. I think that the when you mentioned Boris Johnson's comment, I mean, I was kind of, you know, it's funny. When I first looked at that particular game of beach volleyball, my first reaction was, is this a game or is this something that people are passing off as we're trying to sexualize the games? And then on the other hand, after you watch it and really watch it, these are incredible athletes who are playing this game that is not part of the Olympics.
Right.
But that,
absolutely.
You know, but that's not what we look at. That's not how it's. That's not, at least in the women's side, that's not how it's portrayed nor played.
Right, absolutely. So it's unfortunate because, again, when we talk about the language, we often they kept calling the women gymnasts emotional, right? But when the men gymnasts would get upset because they didn't perform well or were very focused, they got called passionate and committed, right? So you get this narrative where the female athletes are very much being stereotyped sort of according to these social norms that say, you know, women are emotional or they're sexual or they're this, that, and the other. And all that does is take away from the fact of recognizing that these are world-class athletes doing things that none of the rest of us can do. And not only that, but representing their country under intense, intense pressure at the same time.
410-319-8888. Let's open the phones here. We're getting Dave Zirin back. 410-319-8888, and we're here with Sarah Jackson, Dr. Sarah Jackson. She's been writing for the Huffington Post, and I want to cover a lot of territory here today with our two guests. One of the things that I was really want to focus on a little bit is the number of Afro-European athletes at this Olympics was also mind-boggling, and talk about what that means as well. And let's go to Reverend Meredith in Charles Village. You're up now. Welcome.
Hello. Greetings, everybody.
Hi.
I was going to comment on the Olympics. I just love Gabby Douglas and her story. And the interesting part about her story is that her, I think, grandparents are actually Nichiren Buddhist pioneers, being one of the first black Buddhist to practice in North Carolina. So she comes from a line of very strong people. So I was glad to see that she really, really, really gives an example of what you can do with diligence, patience, and endurance. So that actually, like, that made my heart sing during the Olympics. Thank you all.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that was amazing. What she, I think Dave put it well. I mean, it's what she represents. And what she stood for, just as inspiration, as opening up the sport, you know, to a really different level of thinking that wasn't there before. 410-319-8888, Gary in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Tyler, and hello, Dave Zirin, if you're there. I just was online, and my understanding is that Dave Zirin either is on or he's going to be on.
He'll be right. He's. I think they're patching right back in.
Okay. Well, anyway, that's my homie, you know. And Mark, you're one of my homies also. And I just wanted to give both of you props. Wanted to just give a shout out across the ethers to Dr. John Carlos, Muhammad Ali, this whole Olympic thing is freaking huge, and there's just too much inside of me right now that wants to bust out, but I just want to just say thank you both again for doing the hard work that you do.
Thank you so much, Gary.
All right.
One of the things there was a beautiful photograph I saw today after the wrestling match. I don't know if you saw this or not. But it was a picture of the American gold medalist Jordan Burroughs, who was the middleweight wrestling champion when he won over Iran's Sadek Gudarzi in their freestyle championship, who won the silver. And there's a picture of the two of them, just a picture from the back of them, and here they have their arms around one another, both holding their flowers with the medals around their neck. The back of his jacket says United States of America. The back of his jacket says the Islamic Republic of Iran. And that's a picture I wish we could wrestle with its implications, Sarah.
Yeah, and, you know, Dave might be more qualified to speak on the politics there than I am. But it's definitely, I Googled the photo as you were discussing it, and it's a beautiful photo, and it sort of goes to the spirit of the games that we talk about it being a place where, you know, we're working to overcome differences across nations. And, you know, significantly in this game, we also had several female athletes who are Muslim, practicing Muslims, compete in hijab, in head coverings. And that was also very significant.
Yes.
In terms of just exposing people to different cultures and to the idea that these different cultures can come together and get along. Of course, that doesn't change the fact that, you know, in this case, the politics between the U.S. and Iran are very complicated. And it's sort of this nice idea that the Olympics are bringing us together. But in practice, you know, that's a whole other set of issues around politics and government that have to be taken into consideration.
Dave, welcome back. We were talking about that picture of John Burroughs and Sadek Gudarzi.
Right.
You saw that picture.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And what it could symbolize for us to kind of wrestle with. I mean, I know we make a great deal of the Olympics being this place where people come together and kind of a semi-kumbaya moment, but there's some substance to that stuff as well.
Yeah, I mean, there is and there isn't. I mean, the ultimate kumbaya moment historically was Jesse Owens and the German track star who he competed against so closely during the 1936 Olympics. And somehow that didn't avert World War II. So as much as we like these moments, and as much as these moments can make us feel warm and fuzzy about what we're watching, I mean, I think the Olympics, you have to, at the starting point of the Olympics, we have to understand that it's a big commercial. And that's why NBC last night cut an hour of the closing ceremonies, because they were trying to sculpt it to what Americans would want to see. That's why there's so much brand protection around the Olympics, where you have the brand police running around to make sure you're not taking unwanted corporate logos into Olympic facilities. And that's why so much of the United States was cursed with not being able to see the events live and had to enter a kind of cone of silence if you actually wanted to be surprised when you saw the games come primetime.
Right. Yeah, Dave's absolutely right about that. I mean, the fact that NBC didn't air the games live was all about them getting advertisers and ratings. So it was all about them wanting to run the games during prime time so that they could get a certain number of viewers during prime time and sell advertising slots during prime time. So that was very much just about money. And, you know, NBC took a lot of criticism for that, but it reflects a lot about how the contemporary media environment works, where even in the age of the internet, where we can get information about who's winning instantaneously, that a major network like NBC would choose to essentially keep the American public in the dark to some extent in order to sort of maintain their advertising income.
And there's something also about how NBC tells some of these stories that I'm sure we all find very inspiring, that's very important too. Like how they tell these human interest stories, whether it's about nations coming together or whether it's about an athlete overcoming hardship to make it to the Olympic Games, how those stories are told and the importance of writers and journalists and shows like yours, Mark, who tell the other side of those stories, I think is really important. And I think Gabby Douglas's story is a great example of it, because the story is told, and it's told about having a single mom and all her siblings and having to travel to West Des Moines, Iowa, where she thought she was the only African-American person in the state of Iowa, and having to rise up and be homeschooled for 2 years, crushing loneliness and all the rest of it, and then overcoming all those obstacles. And this is told in a kind of Horatio Alger way of saying, wow, look at that. If you try hard enough, you can make it. Instead of taking a step back and saying, wow, that's kind of sick that you have to go through all that if you want to make the Olympic Games. And wow, how segregated is the United States of America that a young girl could go to Iowa and think she's the only black person in the entire state? And what does that say about this country, instead of just clapping our hands for Gabby Douglas's triumph?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Dave. And, you know, I think the sad thing about the coverage of Gabby Douglas is, as much as it's sort of told as like this, you know, very like bootstrap, you know, raising up from the bootstrap sort of mythology within American culture, the media has also done some pretty, in my opinion, underhanded things in covering her, which is that, you know, they took this story that was really a non-story about a few people tweeting on Twitter about her hair, and major media outlets all over the country picked up this story, and journalists, interviewers at the Olympics started asking Gabby Douglas questions about her hair. Now, that should have never been a story in the first place. As far as I'm concerned, it should have died on the internet. But the fact that major news outlets picked up this story sort of goes back to, you know, the thing I wrote about how women athletes are always being, you know, criticized. But in particular, in the case of a black female athlete like Gabby Douglas, are under an extra set of pressure. You know, you saw the same thing with the Williams sisters in tennis, and you saw the same thing with Lolo Jones, where there have been these narratives within the media that have been essentially takedowns of these athletes because of things that have nothing to do with their athletic ability, but rather have to do with fitting into larger narratives about race and gender within America.
Mm. And I think the Lolo Jones story has another layer to it about women athletes, where you had several of the other women on the team willing to speak publicly in disparaging terms about Lolo Jones. And, of course, that's all the media needed to run with that. But some of the concerns and critiques by the other female athletes speaks to a very central debate in women's sports, which is, do you have to be attractive to the male eye? Do you have to pose in Playboy's Women of the Olympics issue? Do you have to sell out to sexism to actually be recognized for your athletic greatness? Is that the price that you have to pay to even be noticed? And that was something that was very much there with Lolo Jones, with the fact that she was picked up very early on by the media as being a kind of representative star for women athletes. The fact that the women athletes, particularly the other hurdlers, felt like she was chosen because of her looks, and then feeling like an absence of solidarity there to stand together and say, Maxim magazine should not have to be the arbiter of who gets recognized as a great athlete.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely true. And, you know, I think it's important to note that part of what made Lolo Jones somebody that the media was willing to link onto and willing to attach about her looks was the fact that she's light-skinned, that she's racially ambiguous, and that she sort of fits this, like, well, anyone can identify with her, you know, in the minds of many people in especially advertising and things like that. Whereas, you know, we have great athletes like Carmelita Jeter and, you know, all these other women who actually performed much better than Lolo Jones in the Olympics who have faced criticism about the shape of their bodies. You know, people have criticized Carmelita Jeter for looking too masculine, right, because she doesn't fit this sort of mainstream narrative about what a woman should look like, right? And that's not something that's fair for her to have to face. She is strong and incredible, and if you watch her run, it's mind-blowing. And she has worked hard to accomplish that, and that's why her body looks the way it looks, which is all that really needs to be said about it, as far as I'm concerned.
It was kind of crazy to see mainstream, respectable sports magazines refer to Lolo Jones, one, as looking like Sheryl Crow, who is, of course, not biracial, or two, referring to her as her exotic good looks.
Right.
Which the word exotic only qualifies if you've never met a biracial person in your entire life, which maybe this particular person in the media never did. But even the phrase exotic is problematic for about 59 different reasons. But at the end, what you have is a very real frustration in women's sports and among women athletes, because I think the root of the frustration is, like, people are proud of their athletic accomplishments. They're proud of their bodies. They're proud of what they're able to do. But at the same time, they feel like that at some point it's like, wait a minute, but Billie Jean King did not have to pose for Playboy.
Mm-hmm.
Martina Navratilova did not have to be in ESPN's body issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and male photographers who seem to see breasts as a muscle group should not be the people who decide who gets highlighted as a great women athlete. And my goodness, the same debate, I know for a fact, has taken place on the U.S. women's soccer team.
Mm-hmm.
About this question about, like, Hope Solo, who gets got the Sports Illustrated cover and who posed in Vogue and all the rest of it. And meanwhile, you have Abby Wambach, who doesn't meet those same kind of very stereotypical beauty requirements. And yet she's the one who's the actual leader on the field.
These have been really good, important statements you're all making. I'm going to go back to the phones here. A lot of people called in and want to comment on some of the things we've been talking about. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Taliva Makin, I believe, is the way the name is pronounced. You're on the air. Hi, right, Taliva, you're there.
Yeah, I watch the Olympics, and I enjoy them. When I see the South Africans, I've never seen black South Africans in the Olympics. Is there any reason why they're not allowed in the Olympics or whatever? I'm just curious.
That's an interesting question. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, there was a very prominent South African woman with black skin who actually fits in very strongly with everything we've been discussing.
Yeah, Caster Semenya.
Caster Semenya, who won the silver medal and who was subject to all kinds of vicious, brutal gender testing because her she was a world record holder, and the people she beat, particularly from Australia, started to raise the issue that she must be part man or something, like raising those kinds of Cold War fears that she'd taken so many steroids that she actually was now a man, and she had to go through all kinds of gender testing as a teenager. She was on suicide watch at one point, and yet emerged from all of that to still win silver, which I think is just an unbelievable accomplishment given everything she's had to go through. I will say that, yes, that's absolutely right. Given the percentages of black versus white or Afrikaans, South African athletes, it's there are more athletes with white skin of African descent in the Olympics, and that does have to do very much with the politics of poverty. I was just in South Africa before the World Cup, and every people would say, just if you'd ask them, they'd say, yeah, we defeated racial apartheid, but now we have economic apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
And people speak about it very openly with a lot of bitterness about some of the dashed dreams of the ruling ANC. So it doesn't surprise me that their athletic delegation would reflect that.
Yeah, and I think that you can see from the pictures of the team itself, which I was looking up as we were kind of talking about this, that the number of white South Africans on the team outnumbered black South Africans.
Mm-hmm.
And as you can clearly see it, I mean, there were a lot of black athletes, but that was kind of glaring, especially in some of the team sports, which have always been kind of traditional prep school clubs that were always all white in South Africa. So that,
yeah, I mean, if you're talking about things like field hockey and, you know, other sports that require a certain level of economic privilege
right.
to even play them at all, then, yeah, that's very much what you're seeing reflected with the South African team, is that a lot of these sports required families that had money, that could pay for coaches, that could, you know, pay for the equipment, that could pay for their kids to go to camp. And like Dave mentioned, you know, just because, you know, the legal apartheid has ended in South Africa, it certainly does not mean that the economic equality exists there, right, any more than it does here in the U.S. And so that's sort of what you see with the team there, I think.
Well, this has been really fascinating, and I do appreciate the time you've taken today. You've raised a lot of really critical issues, and I would love – you two are great together. I'd love to have you back both on at the same time again.
Oh, thanks.
Love to do it.
This is great. Dave Zirin, please catch him at Edge of Sports, both his column on the web and his writing in The Nation magazine, and Edge of Sports on satellite radio, Dr. Sarah Jackson's writing, and the Huffington Post and other places. We'll link to all their work on our website. Dave Zirin and Dr. Sarah Jackson, thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Folks, we're going to take a very brief break. And when we return, we're going to take a look at discuss what happened with the choosing of Paul Ryan as Romney's running mate. We're going to take a look at that from folks who are covering it in Wisconsin. We're also going to take a look at it from a Democratic Party perspective and a Republican Party perspective. So please stay with us. Don't go away.